It's 4:06, and you're listening to Central Time on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. I'm Veronica Rickert.
And I'm Rob Ferret. Later this hour, we'll talk about why paying attention to the health of our gut is one of the most important things we can do to feel better.
First, though, it's the latest on the Affordable Care Act and how states may be changing their plans if people can't sign up through the federal marketplace by January 1st.
Here in Wisconsin, Governor Scott Walker moved 92,000 people off of Badger Care. The idea was that those people could sign up for the Affordable Care Act. They're going to lose their state Medicaid on January 1st, which may leave them without coverage altogether.
Last week, Milwaukee Mayor Tom Barrett asked Scott Walker to extend coverage for those 92,000 people on Badger Care until March 31st.
Here with us to talk about what Wisconsin and other states are doing is Politico health reporter Kyle Chaney. Kyle, thanks for being with us today.
Great to be here.
So a lot of states are planning to phase out their insurance options in favor, as we're doing here in Wisconsin, of moving people onto what people are calling Obamacare. Where is that happening? Where did you look at?
It's happening in different spots around the country. It's particularly some of the sickest residents who have been part of these so-called high-risk pools for a long time. They're being moved. They're supposed to be moved over to the new exchanges that are going live on January 1st. But as you mentioned, the problems that they've experienced so far is leading to some fears that they'll be without coverage. You also mentioned in Wisconsin, and it's a particularly special case because they're moving so many enrollees in Badger Care onto the exchanges. And so I think Wisconsin, almost more than any other state, is depending on the exchanges to be running well, and so far they haven't been.
And so a lot of states are feeling a bit of panic. Are these people going to be able to be registered when this cutoff date happens?
Exactly. We're seeing within the states some maneuvers now, just some contingency plans to say, oh, no, if these exchanges aren't ready to go when these people who are losing coverage need to get on the exchange, we better have some plan Bs in place. So I think we may hear more about that the closer we get to January 1st if there isn't resolution. But you are starting to see governors and legislatures start to take some emergency actions here to protect their residents.
Well, we'll look at some of the other states, but let's start with Wisconsin. What are you seeing here? How does Wisconsin compare to other states juggling this issue?
You know, it's funny because, as I mentioned, Wisconsin is probably most dependent on the exchanges working because of how many people are being moved over. But they're also in a position now where they need this to work. So I talked to some senior officials there in the health department and the insurance department who said, you know, we're taking the Obama administration's word that this site's going to be up and running by the end of November. But as you mentioned, too, we're hearing some increasing pressure, you know, particularly from Democrats, to be honest, who are actually supportive of the health law, saying, you know, we need a plan B in place. And right now there isn't necessarily a contingency. But I think, again, the closer we get to the end of this month without a solution to the federal problems that we're seeing, you may start to hear more about what do we do for those 92,000 people.
So run down some examples from our other states here in the Midwest and how they're tackling this issue.
Indiana is one where I mentioned high-risk pools, where Indiana has about 6,800 residents enrolled in this high-risk pool. They're some of the sickest. And what they've done is, you know, the governor there has moved to spend state money, millions of dollars that they shouldn't have had to if the exchange was running properly, on extending their coverage an extra month into 2014, and with leaving open the option to extend it further if problems persist. We see in Detroit, there was initially a plan to move some early retirees onto the exchange. I think it was about 7,500, and they're going to be they remain in their current coverage again at the expense of the city. So, you know, those are the kind of options, smaller scale right now, things that we're seeing, but it is a sign of building momentum for states to step in on their own and cities as well.
In talking to the officials doing this, are you getting a sense that they're not real happy that they're seeing the need to do this?
Frustration is sort of the magic word right now, and I think that's where it's staying to this point. I think frustration could spill over into something more serious if the administration's assurances that by end of November things will be up and running smoothly don't pan out. Then you may start to see some real recriminations here. And you know, we don't know what that world looks like, because right now the administration has said that this will be without doubt up and running. But you know, it's a tall order that they even acknowledge is an aggressive and ambitious timetable. But I think until then, they're sort of keeping things calm by saying they'll have it up and running.
Wisconsin's one of the many states that left it to the federal government to relying on the federal exchanges. A number of states, though, did their own exchange system. Are they doing any better? Are they seeing a better picture now?
It's hit or miss in the states. On the whole, yes. The states that are running things on their own have reported much smoother experiences, in particular Washington, Kentucky, and even California are reporting experiences that have been far better than states relying on the federal government. But you've also got states like Vermont where they're saying, you know, we're not ready to go here. In Vermont, the governor there extended current insurance plans or moved to extend current insurance plans to make sure people get enrolled or don't lose coverage on January 1st, as we mentioned was possible in Wisconsin. And there's a couple other states where they're eyeing solutions like that because enrollment hasn't worked smoothly.
Do you get a sense on either side of states saying, ah, geez, we should have gone the other way, we should have gone with a federal instead of our state one, or we should have done our own state thing and not relied on the feds?
Not so much from the state implementing it, but I think at least as part of the political discussion, you hear a lot of Democrats and supporters of the Affordable Care Act saying, hey, you know, for all those Republicans who are complaining now that things aren't working, if they had just built it themselves, they wouldn't be going through this. So that's proof that their obstruction, you know, was actually detrimental to their own people. But on the other side, you're not hearing a lot of, oh, maybe we should reconsider now. In Wisconsin, they said, look, our taxpayers have already paid for a federal website to work. We're not going to spend taxpayer dollars on a state-run website, too.
President Obama apologized today to people who are losing their health care. Are those really the people being kicked off BadgerCare that he's talking to?
Those are not the people he's talking to, and that's why Wisconsin is such a special case. He's talking to people on the individual insurance market. These are people who don't get coverage through their employer, a lot of freelancers, people who work, part-time jobs or self-employed. Those are the people, 5% of the population in the country, who are losing their health coverage in large part because they don't meet the standards of the Affordable Care Act. So the president, when he promised that people could keep their health plans if they liked them, you know, now he's saying, well, I didn't mean those people. And I think that's where some of the anger is coming. And so his apology was really aimed at them.
And what is having to make this apology mean for President Obama and his administration? How bad is it? How bad is the political fallout for them?
It's a game changer. And I think, you know, the president's and the administration's idea is that this will help turn the page on that and rebuild some momentum. And then, you know, assuming that the law does get up and start working more smoothly, this will be an episode that's forgotten. But it does change the game because politically that Republicans now say, well, if he's apologizing, he should be open to some legislative changes to make this law less harmful to the people who are losing their plans. So they're going to be pushing that way more aggressively. I think at least in the short term, they're going to be motivated to get the president on board with some of the changes they're proposing. So it's not going to go away anytime soon.
Do you have a sense that what the federal government is saying is right, that they'll have the system, the website, mostly up and running by the end of the month?
Well, they've left little breathing room for themselves on this. And, you know, in our experience talking to tech experts and to administration officials themselves, they acknowledge that that's a pretty ambitious schedule and no guarantee. Politically, they've left themselves no wiggle room, but and they continue to report daily progress and knocking items off their so-called punch list of problems that they're trying to tackle. But the tech experts we talk to say that's no guarantee. December 1st is not a sure bet. And then again, all bets are off as to what the fallout would look like.
And do you see, to wrap up, more states doing what you had looked at in places like Indiana, looking at maybe extending various kinds of insurance?
Part states are being a little coy about it because they're hopeful, whether they support this law or not, they're hopeful that this enrollment system gets a little smoother so they don't have to take those kind of emergency actions. We've seen it again in Indiana extending coverage. They really were worried about people, the sickest people losing care, so that's a really dire situation. And so I think they felt like they had no choice. And I think some states feel like they still have a choice as long as that November timetable's met.
All right, Kyle, thanks a lot for joining us today.
Thank you very much.
That's Kyle Chaney. He's healthcare reporter at Politico.
Now we'll check the headlines, and then we'll be back with a look at why gut health matters and what you can do to reduce bloat and feel better. This is Central Time on Wisconsin Public Radio.
This is Central Time. I'm Rob Ferret.
And I'm Veronica Rickert. A lot of people experience gastrointestinal problems like bloating, gas, and constipation. The list goes on. But what causes the problems? A lot of people don't get a clear answer at the doctor, so sometimes they go online to try to figure it out.
We have an expert with us to talk about gut health. But what questions do you have? Have you ever experienced serious gastrointestinal problems? Was there something at work for you? Some advice to share? Give a call at 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. Or send us an email, talk@wpr.org.
Our guest is Dr. Robin Shutkun. She's a gastroenterologist and author of Gut Bliss, a 10-day plan to ban bloat, flush toxins, and dump your digestive baggage. She's also the founder of the Digestive Center for Women. Dr. Robin Shutkun, welcome to Central Time.
Thank you so much for having me.
Well, it seems like gut health is something that is really cresting in terms of how aware people are of it. A lot of people realizing they're not feeling so good in the stomach and their digestive areas. But there's not a lot of information, it seems like, about how to address those problems. Would you say that this is something that's been overlooked?
Absolutely. You know, Hippocrates said, long before I said it, that all disease begins in the gut. And he actually was right. The GI tract is sort of the central wheel, and the different parts of the body are the spokes that come off it. And if from a digestive point of view, all is not well in your digestive tract, it's really hard for the rest of you to feel well. Bloating is something that's been ignored for a long time because it's something that women often complain of and doctors think it's not serious, but it can be a real sign that all is not well in your digestive tract, and it's definitely worth paying attention to.
Well, what kinds of symptoms should we be worried about?
Well, bloating on its own is generally more of a nuisance symptom than a sign of something serious, but in association with other symptoms, it actually can be a signal that there is something very serious going on. For example, ovarian cancer, it's often called a silent killer. But what we realize now is that persistent bloating can be a major sign of ovarian cancer and something that shouldn't be ignored, particularly if it's associated with abdominal pain or weight loss. Same for some more other worrisome diagnoses. So, for example, colon cancer can cause bloating, usually with associated rectal bleeding, some other conditions like Crohn's disease, which is an autoimmune condition. So bloating on its own is not necessarily worrisome, but in conjunction with things like blood in the stool or bleeding in between your menstrual cycle, significant weight loss, more than 10% of your body weight without trying, abdominal pain, these are the sorts of things that should make you seek medical attention for your bloating.
So those are some of the more serious things. On the other hand, it sounds like there are symptoms that we experience when things just are not functioning the way that they should with our digestive health. We could be feeling better. We could be digesting better, but we're not. What are some of the things in terms of the non-scary disease realm that we can do for everyday health?
So, Veronica, there's a couple big categories here, and the food is a huge one. So lactose intolerance, for example, more than 50% of the world's population is lactose intolerant and can't digest dairy. And that might be you. Lots of people eat dairy every day, not necessarily drinking milk, but eating yogurt or cheese, and they feel kind of bloated and uncomfortable every day, and they don't really put the two together. My book has a 10-day plan. It's really a simple elimination diet, and I ask people to get rid of the 6 most common foods associated with bloating, and it very conveniently spells out SAD gas. So the SAD part is soy, artificial sweeteners, and dairy, and the GAS part, gluten, alcohol, and sugar. Soy bloats you because if you eat enough processed soy, it can have estrogen-like effects, causing you to retain water. Artificial sweeteners aren't absorbed in the small intestine. That's why they don't contribute any calories, but they get fermented by bacteria in the large intestine, and they produce a lot of gas that can really bloat you. And then dairy, we talked about, lots of people are lactose intolerant and don't realize it. The gas part can be challenging, the gluten, alcohol, and sugar. Of course, it's a relatively small number of Americans who have celiac disease, which is an actual allergy to gluten, the protein in wheat, rye, and barley. But millions more are gluten intolerant and have bloating and other symptoms, fatigue, sometimes brain fog from gluten. Alcohol in moderation, most people tolerate pretty well, but alcohol can really irritate the lining of the GI tract, and it also decreases production of digestive enzymes that help you break down food. And of course, it just can add calories and inches to your waistline. And then sugar, this is a really tough one, so for most people to give up, or at least to cut down on significantly. When you eat a lot of sugary food, you end up feeding the wrong kind of bacteria in your gut. And you end up with overgrowth of yeast species and some not-so-friendly bacteria that end up producing a lot of gas and bloating you. So what I recommend is eliminating SAD gas, these 6 foods, for 10 days. you'll probably feel a lot better. But if you decide, gosh, there's something I'm really missing and I'm not sure it was really that, I recommend reintroducing one category at a time, sort of a week at a time. If you eliminate sad gas and you feel great and then you go out and have a bagel and all of a sudden you're massively bloated and uncomfortable, that might help you figure out that gluten is a culprit. And you don't necessarily need to avoid it 100% if you don't have celiac disease, but maybe 80% of the time.
Now, in terms of probiotics, that's something that we hear a lot about today. We didn't maybe 10, 15 years ago, but these days, probiotics, the bacteria in the gut, are linked to things like brain health and being able to be resistant to depression. How much do probiotics matter and good bacteria in the gut?
So, Veronica, the microbiome, the billions and trillions of bacteria in your digestive system that make up the microbiome, are an absolutely fascinating area, because what we're realizing is that what you can't see, the gut bacteria, may be more important than what you can. They're incredibly important, not just for the health of the digestive lining, which will determine how well you absorb stuff and whether you have gas or not, but for your immune system. So what we're finding is that kids who are given frequent antibiotics in childhood often will develop autoimmune diseases like asthma and certain allergies like Crohn's, lupus, even diabetes later in life. The Italians are actually quite far ahead of us in the gut bacteria research. And one Italian researcher in particular, Dr. Leonetti in Florence, he did a fascinating study where he looked at the gut bacteria of kids in Florence eating a standard sort of typical Western diet, high in sugar, fat, and meat. And he looked at a group of kids in Burkina Faso eating a mostly plant-based diet with legumes and the occasional termite. And he found that the gut bacteria at birth in both sets of kids were virtually identical. But as soon as the kids migrated to table food, the gut bacteria changed dramatically. The kids in Florence eating the Western diet had less species diversity. So in other words, they had fewer types of bacteria, which is a real problem. It turns out bacterial diversity is really important. And they had more species associated with obesity, inflammatory bowel disease, allergies, and autoimmune diseases. The Burkina Faso kids eating the very unprocessed plant-based diet had species associated with leanness and with less disease. Now, if we take a step forward, what people have sort of put together is like, well, even if you're eating a not-so-great Western diet, we'll just give you back some bacteria. And so a probiotic might seem like a great idea. The problem is we've only isolated several hundred species of gut bacteria. And of that number, we can only culture and grow just a handful of them outside of the gut reliably, things like bifidobacteria, acidophilus, lactobacillus. There are probably hundreds of thousands more gut bacteria that we don't even know of. We
wow.
haven't yet made their acquaintance that are really important for gut health. So one of the really fascinating areas that we're seeing now, and it has a little bit of a yuck factor for anyone who's squeamish, but is something called FMT, fecal microbiome transplants, where we actually take stool from a healthy donor and we insert it into the intestines of somebody with an infection. We're using it now for an infection called Clostridium difficile. And I think this is really the way of the future. It's not the probiotic, which probiotic is kind of like a vitamin. You know, if you decide that tomatoes, if you do a study and you find that people who eat tomatoes are heart healthy and they have fewer heart attacks, and you say, gosh, well, tomatoes contain lycopene, so I'm going to make a vitamin with lycopene and give it to people and see if they have fewer heart attacks. That's all well and good, but there are probably 50,000 other things in the tomato that are really what are helping the heart, and so it's much better to eat a tomato. So again, pardon the yuck factor, but it's probably better to do the whole stool transfer,
wow.
or even better, follow the dietary habits of the people who have a healthy microbiome.
So does that mean we should be trying to eat things that are fermented more, sauerkraut and miso and pickles and things like that? Is
absolutely.
That where we get those good bacteria?
Yes, absolutely. So fermented pickled foods are a great source of good gut bacteria. High-fiber foods, particularly foods that contain a lot of inulin, like artichokes and asparagus, are another great source. Leafy greens. So increasing those foods are great. And then the other part of that is cutting down on the foods that we know promote the growth of the wrong kind of bacteria, the undesirables. So that's a diet that's high in fat and meat, sugary, starchy, sort of processed, unfortunately, the standard American diet. So it's not just a simple matter of going out to the pharmacy and getting a probiotic. That's not going to take you that far if you really have a depleted microbiome. You really have to change your diet. And then another huge part of that, Veronica, is avoiding probably the number one threat to your microbiome, and that's unnecessary antibiotics. We know that most of the time when you have a cold or a sinus infection, it's viral or it's a mild bacterial infection that's going to be self-limited. And so when you take antibiotics in that setting when you don't really need them, you kill off a lot of good gut bacteria that, again, can't just be replaced at the drugstore. So my general advice to patients is, you know, if you really have some very severe illness, absolutely take your antibiotic, but don't reach for an antibiotic every time you sneeze or have a cold.
Well, we're talking right now to Dr. Robert Chutkan. She's a gastroenterologist and the author of Gut Bliss, a 10-day plan to ban bloat, flush toxins, and dump your digestive baggage.
You can join in. Are we talking about you? Do you have questions? Call 800-642-1234. 800-642-1234. You're listening to Central Time on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio.
You're listening to Central Time. I'm Veronica Rickert.
And I'm Rob Ferret.
Our guest is Dr. Robin Chutkan, gastroenterologist and author of Gut Bliss, a 10-day plan to ban bloat, flush toxins, and dump your digestive baggage. She's also the founder of the Digestive Center for Women, and we're talking about the GI problems that people develop. Sometimes they fly under the radar. We don't really notice them. We just notice we're not feeling that great, and we're getting some advice on how to combat that now.
And we're taking your calls, your advice, your questions at 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234, or send an email, talk@WPR.org.
All right, so Robin, let's go to the phones right now. We have Shandy with us in Rhinelander. Hi, Shandy.
Hi, thanks for taking my call. This is a very interesting topic to me because for the last 10 years I've struggled with gut issues.
And what have you found?
Well, 10 years ago I had a hysterectomy. I still have my ovaries, but then I developed IBS. And I tried, you know, diets and prescription medications and probiotics and all sorts of things. And we do know it's hormonally based or triggered. And what we tried just to see if it would work was a low dose of antidepressants with the serotonin, and that actually has, it's not perfect, but it's much better.
What do you think helped about that?
Shandy, I'm so glad to hear from you, and I'm so pleased to hear you're doing better. So, you know, you raise a really important issue here with the serotonin. Serotonin is what we consider the feel-good hormone in the body, and the majority of it is located in the GI tract. So sometimes boosting serotonin levels with drugs like antidepressants can actually really help when with conditions like irritable bowel syndrome. But IBS is one of these diagnoses that I have a bit of a difficult time with because it means irritable bowel syndrome, but it doesn't tell us anything about why your bowel is irritable. And if we slice up the IBS pie, we find all kinds of things from undiagnosed celiac disease to hormonal imbalances, undiagnosed parasites, Crohn's disease, gluten intolerance. So I think when you get a diagnosis like irritable bowel, it's really important to try and pinpoint what exactly is causing the problem. And I'm so delighted that you, through lots of trial and error, were able to figure out what it is. Best of luck to you.
So it sounds like IBS is sort of an umbrella, and then from there, people need to dig deeper.
Absolutely. That's exactly right. They need to keep digging because it's sort of like if you came in to see me and you said you were really tired and I said, well, you have tired disease and here's a pill to pep you up, you know, I sort of like, well,
right.
Why am I tired? You know, is it my thyroid? Is it what's going on?
Okay. Well, thanks so much, Shandy. And we'll move on to Tom next in Delafield. Hi, Tom.
Hello there. I'd just like to add and share what happens to me on occasion. I would get very severe gas pains, and it would, you know, pretty much bring me to my knees, and it would wrap all the way around from my back all the way through my midsection, you know, all the way around. And what my chiropractor told me about that is that there's certain vertebrae that get pinched, it will affect the nerves going to the GI tract, and it would cause this type of gas buildup. And I'm pretty sure that he's right, because when this happens, I can kind of self-adjust this. I lay flat on the floor with a towel rolled up under my back, you know, right where I feel that the vertebrae need to be pushed back into place. And within just a matter of minutes, if I get that just the right spot and everything kind of goes back where it needs to be, I can feel the gas just dissipate and I'm, you know, back up and running again.
Interesting. What do you make of that, Robin?
Tom, thank you, first of all, so much for sharing. And I love to hear these stories where people are, you know, being medical detectives and figuring it out. And with the help of your trusty chiropractor who came up with some really clever ideas here. And, you know, in my book, I mentioned this thing called happy abs, where people lie on their back with something heated on their belly to sort of relax the abdominal muscles and to relax the GI tract, which is also muscular structure. And then they take a very light dumbbell, like 1 or 2 pounds, and they circumnavigate the belly button in a clockwise direction to try and push air out. Yours is a little bit different because it actually has to do with your spine and the vertebrae. But again, it's just a great example of how we need to listen to our bodies and pay attention and find the right people who can help us figure out how to feel better. There's always a reason why you're bloated, why you're having digestive distress. And I really, really encourage our listeners to not just accept that this is how it is, but to roll up their sleeves and figure out why they're not feeling well and try and improve it, whether it's a food you need to eliminate, something you need to add, a massage technique you need to do, something going on with your spine. Keep searching for some answers.
All right. Thanks so much for that call, Tom. And let's go next to Pam in the Wisconsin Dells. Hey, Pam.
Hi. I just wanted to talk about I've been diagnosed with Crohn's disease about 2 years now. But my GI doctor that I have right now, he's not real sure I have Crohn's. He still thinks I have IBS. So I had one GI doctor say you have it and one who's not real sure. But they are treating me. I take Humira injections. I take methotrexate. I take a whole bunch of vitamins, and I have a gluten-free, a soy-free, no beef. Let's say I do it about 95% of the time, beef, and I am feeling so much better.
All right, so a lot of treatments that you're giving yourself that are helping. Sounds like Pam has been a detective as well.
Absolutely.
Dr. Chuck, what about that?
I love the dietary changes, Pam, but, you know, Crohn's disease and IBS are two very different diseases, and it's really important to figure out which one it is, because while the drugs you're on are really effective, and they're drugs that I use in my practice, Humira and methotrexate, they're also pretty heavy-duty guns. I mean, methotrexate can cause liver problems, and Humira can cause, it's an immune suppressant, and it, you know, can cause, in rare circumstances, cancer. So it's really important to find out whether you have Crohn's or not. If one doctor says yes and one doctor says no, maybe a third opinion is in order, because if you cannot take those drugs, that would be fantastic. I applaud your dietary changes, and I would say keep going with that. But I think it really is very, very important to find out. Crohn's is a serious autoimmune disorder, and as a result, the drugs we use are very effective, but they have a lot of side effects. Irritable bowel, you can manage more through dietary modification and some drugs that are more benign. So really encourage you to maybe seek a third opinion and figure out whether you truly have Crohn's or not. But I'm glad you're feeling better.
All right. Well, thank you so much, Pam. Appreciate hearing your story. And Dr. Chuckin, why is it so hard to diagnose these things?
Well, you know, what's really interesting is that even today in 2013, the lag from onset of symptoms to diagnosis for Crohn's disease is 4.5 years.
Ooh,
it's,
wow.
It's really an unbelievable amount of time considering all our modern technology and all these diagnostic things we can do. But that's because the symptoms often develop before we see a lot of active inflammation in the GI tract. And then sometimes with Crohn's, the areas where we get things like ulcers and narrowing are deep within the GI tract. You know, the GI tract is sort of this 30-foot superhighway from the mouth to the anus, but the changes in Crohn's often occur deep in the small bowel beyond the reach of our typical endoscopes that we use for doing colonoscopy and upper endoscopy. And, you know, I will say that there's still a real bias in the medical community when women come in to chalk it up to stress. And, you know, we see it in other fields too. In the emergency room, woman comes in clutching her chest, what we call the classic Levine side of a heart attack, and she often gets Mylanta and gets put in a corner. Man comes in the same age with the same symptoms, clutching his chest, and he gets rushed up to the cath lab for them to check out his heart, even though heart disease is the number one killer of women. So I think there's still this bias to say that, you know, stress is a major component in women. Even the very word for uterus hysteros comes from the Greek, which means hysterical. So they, you know, even the ancient Greeks thought that we were a little bit dramatic. And while we know that stress is a contributor to every illness, lots of times there's something real. There's some a physiological, anatomical basis for symptoms, which brings me to one of my favorite male-female issues. And I will point out that bloating is an equal opportunity employer. Things like food and air swallowing, a condition called aerophagia that can make you go up a pant size in a day, and conditions like diverticulosis and gallbladder problems, those affect men and women. But there is a particular difference between males and females that make women more susceptible to bloating, and that's our colons. Women have a colon that, on average, is 10 centimeters longer than the male colon. And we think that's to allow for more absorption during childbirth. We also have a deeper, wider pelvis, so our colon sits really deep. It has to compete for space with our female reproductive organs, the uterus, the fallopian tubes, the ovaries. So the female colon looks like a Six Flags roller coaster, and the male colon is a nice, gentle horseshoe. And so it means in women, the products of digestion, the gas, the air, the stool has to travel through all these twists and turns and loops and loop-de-loops and switchbacks just to come out. Women also have lower testosterone levels, and in men, higher testosterone levels mean a stronger abdominal wall that binds the bowel in place. It's like a built-in Spanx. So even when men have a bare belly, they'll complain of being fat, but often not of being bloated because of their tighter abdominal wall. So these are all things to take into consideration. Women have more undiagnosed thyroid disease, which can cause bloating, fluctuating progesterone and estrogen levels. So we have a couple advantages when it comes to bloating that actually turn out to be disadvantages.
If you could just give the people listening one tip to help with things like this, what would you tell them?
So I'm going to give you just an easy, all-natural bloating tip, and that is fennel seeds and ginger. So assuming that your bloating is not from something serious, but maybe you ate something that didn't agree with you, boil some fennel seeds and make a tea. Strain the seeds off. You can use a little honey to sweeten and make a fennel tea. Very soothing for the GI tract. Fennel is from the carrot and parsley family, has lots of medicinal qualities. Ginger chews are another great way. Now, don't overdo it with ginger candy, which has a lot of sugar in it, but you can get a little bit of caramelized ginger, and you can keep them in your purse, and ginger is another great natural bloat buster. So,
all right. Well, thank you so much for that idea, and thank you for your time today.
Thanks for having me.
That was Dr. Robin Chutton. She is a gastroenterologist and the author of Gut Bliss, a 10-day plan to ban, bloat, flush toxins, and dump your digestive baggage.
Coming up next, it's our weekly news roundup with WPR News Director Michael Leland. This is Central Time here on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio.
This is Central Time. I'm Veronica Rickert.
And I'm Rob Ferret.
Coming up after the news from NPR, we'll find out when emotional lows cross the line into depression and what to do about it. But first, it's time for our state news roundup with WPR's news director, Michael Leland.
Michael, thanks for joining us again.
Yeah, happy to be here.
So one of the big pieces of news, an ongoing story, Wisconsin's voter ID laws, like a lot of legislation in this state, it's ended up in the courts.
Yes, this is the subject of a couple of lawsuits, and eventually it'll be heard in state court. But earlier this week, a federal trial got underway. This involves two federal lawsuits that were filed on behalf of dozens of individuals by several organizations, including Milwaukee Area Labor Council and the American Civil Liberties Union. Now, one of them was on behalf of an elderly woman who was born in rural Tennessee. Her name is Betty Jones. She never got a birth certificate. She had difficulty voting in Wisconsin because she also didn't have a driver's license. And her daughter testified this week that she spent months dealing with Wisconsin officials to get her mother the ID she needed. And that's just one example that's being cited as to how requiring an ID makes it more difficult for some people to vote.
So the burden, they're saying, is too great. It's keeping people from voting, and that's why there's this legal challenge to the law.
Exactly. And they're saying this falls particularly heavy on minorities and low-income people who are less likely to have a state driver's license or ID than the general population.
And supporters, though, still in favor of the law. What's the argument that they're going with?
Yeah, they say it'll prevent voter fraud by making people prove who that they are, who they say they are, before casting a ballot, just like you would if you were going to rent a car, or if you still rent DVDs, you have to prove who you say you are for that sort of thing, too. So that's the same argument.
And I think I heard a report from Wisconsin Public Radio that the bigwig in Wisconsin's Government Accountability Board was in one of these trials.
Right. Chuck Hornbach reported that yesterday the head of the Government Accountability Board, Kevin Kennedy, testified that he had recommended that lawmakers help people avoid some of these difficulties in getting birth certificates or other documents in order to get the state driver's licenses or ID cards they need to vote. Kennedy said that he advised allowing people to sign an affidavit that confirms their identity and would allow them to vote. That's something other states that have voter ID allowed, but it's not in the Wisconsin law. He also says, by the way, that the legislature didn't give the Government Accountability Board nearly enough money to help publicize the new voter ID law.
And do you have a sense of how long these trials are going to be running?
Yeah, they said it's going to be a two-week trial, so by this point we're about halfway through it, and it's expected to wrap up sometime later next week.
And these are things that can always be appealed at a higher level.
Absolutely.
So we'll be talking about this one maybe for weeks to come.
Yes.
Another big issue coming up, I think, next week, abortion in the state legislature.
Right. Actually, a little bit of a change today. This was something that was supposed to happen and now looks like it might not. Now, these are two bills that were up for a vote next week regarding abortion. One would ban abortions based on the sex of the fetus. The other would prevent public employees' health plans from covering most abortions and would limit the ability of employees who work for religious organizations to get contraception through their insurance plans. Now, they could get contraceptives if they're being prescribed for reasons other than preventing a pregnancy. The Assembly added that provision last summer. Now, what's changed is those bills were passed by a Senate committee this week. They were scheduled for debate and a vote on Tuesday. Today we found out that the agenda for Tuesday does not include those bills. A spokesman for the Senate Republican leader, Scott Fitzgerald, says the GOP wants to end this year on a non-controversial note, and the items may come up next year. Tuesday, of course, is the last day of the legislative session.
And this would have been a controversial note preemptively, right? Some Democrats were saying, whoa, hold off on this.
Yes, even more than that, Democratic State Senator John Erpenbach was very much in opposition of both bills. He said there had never been a public hearing on that provision. The Assembly added that said people, you know, could get prescriptions if they were being prescribed for reasons other than preventing a pregnancy. He said there should have been a public hearing on that. He was promising what he was calling all-out hell on Tuesday if the Senate tried to debate and then vote on these bills. Republicans had said that there's a precedent for not holding a public hearing on the amendments, that they didn't need one, and now it looks like all those may be pushed into next year anyway.
You mentioned not wanting to end the session on a controversial note. There's not much session left.
Right. Tuesday is the last scheduled day of the session.
Okay. So that would have been a controversial note to go
right
out on.
Right.
Well, another one that's got a lot of attention passed this mascot bill, the high school or the school mascots bill.
Right. These are now, we're moving into the segment of our discussion where we talk about things we're waiting to happen. So earlier this week, the state Senate passed a bill that would have made it more difficult for school districts to change Native American-themed mascots or logos. Now, under the current law, any resident in a district can file a complaint with the state's Department of Public Instruction if they feel that the local mascot or nickname promotes discrimination. The state superintendent's office could then order it to be changed. The new law would require somebody who wants to file a complaint like that to also turn in signatures that are equal to 10% of the student population in that district. And, of course, a district could be exempt from the complaint if a tribe said, yeah, we approve of that nickname, the logo, or the mascot.
And the people who sponsored this bill, their argument was the threshold's too low. We need to see more signs from the community that there's a problem with this. Is that right?
Exactly. One of the supporters is saying that under the current law, a school district is almost looked upon as being guilty just because it has a Native American mascot or logo. They said this levels the playing field, gives them an opportunity to defend the complaint, and gives local tribes an opportunity to weigh in and say, no, actually, we don't find that that's offensive. For the most part, Wisconsin's 11 tribes say that they are against the idea of using mascots and, you know, logos, Indian mascots and logos. So, you know, where that falls is kind of hard to say.
Their argument is it's bad regardless of what the community in question thinks about
exactly.
Now, and speaking communities, one is kind of in limbo here, right?
Right. McWanago was among the school districts that was caught up in the law as it exists now. Someone filed a complaint. The DPI said, change your name and change the logo. And McGuanago has been trying to hang on to it. So right now, it's sort of in limbo. It's waiting to see what happens with this law before deciding to take its next steps.
So Assembly passed it. Senate passed it. If I remember my civics class, it's on the governor's desk now, and?
It's in the inbox, and he has not said whether he will sign it. This is another one of those items he's been saying this week is not really on his radar. He's thinking more about jobs and the economy, but at some point he is going to have to do something with this.
And then maybe the biggest story of the week is something that didn't happen, and this one does have jobs and economic impact to it, the proposed casino in Kenosha.
Right, something that continues not to happen. This is that $800 million casino and entertainment complex that the Menominee want to build in Kenosha. The governor is the person who has to decide whether this project goes ahead or not. So we've been on casino watch for the last couple of weeks. Now, the governor had said he'd have a decision by about 2 weeks ago today. Then last week, he said he was reviewing more information, maybe would have a decision within a few days. And then this morning, he told Chuck Kornbach and other reporters in Milwaukee he didn't expect to have a decision today and maybe didn't even really have a timeline anymore. He says he's going to take what he calls the appropriate amount of time to make the right decision.
Well, people have been trying to read tea leaves on this for a while, trying to glean from the governor's statements which way he's leaning on this. If he still hasn't made a decision, are you getting the sense that he's not necessarily leaning now?
It's really hard to say. Last week, if you looked at, last week he was sending out these daily statements mm-hmm. of, this is what I'm thinking of today. And many of them seem to be leaning toward the idea that he might not approve this, saying that all 11 Wisconsin tribes didn't support the casino, something he said would be important, pointing out that this new casino would draw in, create a lot more gambling revenue than the Dairyland dog racing track that mm-hmm. it replaces. So it was looking like he might be leaning toward no. Now he said, he says he's balancing the need for jobs in the Kenosha area with the possibility that jobs could be lost in other counties if the casino is built. So still really hard to say for sure which way he's leaning.
And then the other tribes, key tribes say we're still not on board with this.
Exactly. The Potawatomi operates a casino in Milwaukee. The Ho-Chunk have a casino near the Wisconsin Dells. Both of them had said that this new casino in Kenosha would hurt their business, presumably by taking away the customer base from the Chicago area that would come up to, up to Wisconsin. And, you come over the border, there's Kenosha. Why would you drive any further?
I often end these discussions about a particular topic by saying, what do you reckon the timeline is, Michael? But I've got a feeling that my guess is just about as good as yours at this point.
Exactly. The governor says he doesn't really have a timeline. He's going to take what he's calling the appropriate amount of time. I think he has about a year officially to make this decision.
Oh.
But he has said that, he's not necessarily on a specific timeline right now.
And I imagine both sides are trying to convey their message to him however they can.
Exactly.
All right, Michael, thanks a lot for joining us.
All right, have a good weekend.
That was WPR's news director, Michael Leland. And we round up the top state news stories this week, each Friday at this time.
Coming up, we'll look at unhappiness and when it starts to blur into depression. Our guest will have some practical advice on dealing with life when you're almost depressed.
This is Central Time on Wisconsin Public Radio.